From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a U.S. bipartisan congressional compromise on the Iran nuclear deal. 2015 shaping up as the deadliest year for migrants crossing the Mediterranean. An investigative author says Islam is being corrupted. And fighting negative stereotypes of Muslims in light of ISIS.
You say that, you know, this is a minority of a minority, and they, you know, they are killing innocent people, and we have to stop it.
It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. It appears likely that the U.S. Congress will be able to review and potentially reject any final nuclear agreement between six world powers and Iran, following Tuesday's unanimous vote in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on a compromise measure. If approved by the full Senate, the House of Representatives, and signed by the President into law, the measure would cut congressional review time of any agreement from 60 to 30 days. It would require the President to send Congress a detailed report every 90 days on Iran's compliance with a nuclear agreement, its ballistic missile program, and its support of terrorism. Congress will also have the final say on lifting its sanctions on Tehran. President Obama will have the power to veto Congress's decision. The White House has indicated it will support the compromise measure. Nabil Khoury, a Middle East scholar at both Northwestern University and the Atlantic Council, tells VOA's Victor Beatty, a key to the compromise is that the measure does not interfere with ongoing negotiations aimed at a final nuclear agreement by June 30th.
They're willing to wait until the final agreement is worked out in June, towards the end of June. They are going to request from the White House 90-day periods where they check on the implementation by Iran of the agreement. I think that's a good thing because, frankly, the White House can use that as a bargaining chip with Iran, in that they need to make sure that they phase out the sanctions, and that if they don't do that, Congress would interfere and not ratify the agreement. This strengthens, I think this current bill is a good one. It strengthens the White House's hand, does not weaken it.
Why does it strengthen it?
Because John Kerry can tell his Iranian counterpart that his hands are somewhat tied by Congress, that he cannot approve a wholesale lifting of the sanctions, and that he has to constantly reporting to Congress on progress. Otherwise, the deal is off. We'll see. I mean, I think now the ball is in Iran's court to see whether they're going to finish the details, agree to the details of this, because so far it's just a framework agreement.
Will this agreement announced today, this compromise in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, of course it has to be approved by both houses of Congress and signed by the President before it becomes law, will this assuage the concerns that Iran has and Israel?
Iran will probably protest, but they don't have any choice. They will think that the Congress is making this a tougher deal for them. Israel is still suspicious. The fact that the Republicans are going ahead with this may help a bit with Israel. But the only thing new is that the Republicans who invited Netanyahu to speak to Congress against the agreement, that majority is now going ahead with this. So it weakens Netanyahu's position a little bit. It weakens his complaint.
The sanctions regime seems to be cracking already with the indication that Russia is prepared to sell Iran air defense missile systems. The whole matter of sanctions, once they're lifted, they cannot be reimposed. I know that there's going to be this periodic review to see if Iran is coming through on its side of the agreement. But once sanctions are gone, do you think they can be reimposed?
The Russian deal is really almost on a separate track. It breaks the sanctions in a way because there's not supposed to be any sales of weapons to Iran. But the real sanctions that are hurting Iran are the economic ones where Iran is not able to earn as much money as it used to. On this deal, they're going to be spending money, not earning money. It's almost on a separate track and has to do with the issue of how much it strengthens Iran militarily. This is something the administration has objected to for a long time, not because of the sanctions regime, but because they don't want Iran to have these weapons.
Will this complicate matters, this vote by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee?
No, I don't think the vote in the Senate will complicate matters. I think we'll hear some noises from both Iran and Israel objecting, but it won't really affect the deal itself. That still stands or falls on its own.
Nabil Khoury, a Middle East scholar at both Northwestern University and the Atlantic Council. Israel's intelligence minister, Yuval Steinitz, told Israel Radio today the compromise legislation working its way through Congress is an achievement for Israeli policy, which he says is vital in preventing a bad deal with Iran. International rights agencies say 2015 is shaping up to be the deadliest year for migrants crossing the Mediterranean Sea. In the latest tragedy, the human rights group Save the Children says an estimated 400 people, many of them children, lost their lives while making the dangerous crossing from Libya to Italy. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The month of April is only half over, and yet it has been extraordinary in terms of the number of people rescued at sea. Official figures indicate the Italian Coast Guard has picked up more than 7,000 migrants between April 10th and 13th. Save the Children says some 450 of them are children, 317 unaccompanied by an adult. Joel Millman, a spokesman for the International Organization for Migration, says so far about 8,000 people have been rescued in April. These numbers, he says, indicate the 2015 migrant smuggling season is in full swing.
We're on pace to be well ahead of last year's totals for all migrant arrivals from Africa into Italy. We're on pace to be five times the rate of fatalities. Past weekend, we passed 500 deaths on the Mediterranean of migrants leaving Africa. This time last year, there were 47, although by the end of April 2014, that had grown to 96. So we're at least five times the first 4 months of 2014's rate.
Millman says the tide of migration from Libya toward Italy is growing at a far more alarming and more deadly rate this year than last. He says many more migrants are fleeing Libya and making the precarious journey across the sea to escape the violent and crime-ridden conditions in that country.
A lot of what we see are people who are part of the traditional workforce that come up through West Africa to work in Libya, but because it's difficult to remit money home and because there's just so much common crime in the streets of cities like Tripoli right now, they're afraid that they can't keep their money, they can't stay safe, so they're seeking a way to get out on these ships.
The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees says at least 3,500 people drowned while attempting to cross the Mediterranean from North Africa in 2014. International humanitarian agencies predict that record number of deaths will be surpassed this year. They are calling on the European Union to step up action to stop this intolerable loss of life. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Mohammed Rehman, an investigative author, says he has traveled to 50 Islamic nations to study how Islam is being practiced. It is his observation that the religion has been corrupted around the world. We asked about his findings.
The actual religion comes from the holy book called the Holy Quran. After 632, after 150 years of that period, the Sharia laws were formed. And that is what is mostly practiced in those 50 countries, which I find is kind of parallel to the actual teachings of the Quran. And because of that, we see blasphemy laws, which are being practiced under the Sharia laws. And because of that, you see exactly what happened in Paris. I mean, the cartoonists were killed under a decree because this law has been created called the blasphemy laws, and these are Sharia laws. And obviously, I find that very concerning because it is something which is parallel to Islam. They call it Islam, but it's not actually conforms with the teaching of the Quran.
What do you believe is the true intent of Islam and the Prophet Muhammad?
The true intent of Islam is the Quran. He was a prophet, and like the Gospels or the Torah. That is how Islam should have been practiced. Unfortunately, it hasn't happened after he passed away. And after 632, the entire process of conversion through invitation was converted to invasion. And then there were parallel laws made, and the result we see today, which we also saw during the times that preceded after that, was invasions and killings and laws which suited people to their needs. And slavery was a part of the situation then. It was widely practiced during the Middle Ages by the Islamic countries also. And they continue to be like that even today. I visited Burkina Faso, Senegal, Mali, Niger, Nigeria, and that belt even today has 6 million slaves. I mean, CNN has done an entire report on that, but obviously their report only goes to the extent that slavery is only in the cocoa plantations and things like that, and that is not correct. And we see that because of Boko Haram and Al-Shabaab and all these organizations and in that region only, there are 6 million slaves. They're used as household servants. They're used for sex trade. Children are sold between $5 and $15, and all that is being advocated today under the banner of Islam and the creation of ICs and Axis and the Taliban and all these sects and the infighting that exists today. And we witnessed that in Tunisia, we witnessed that in Kenya, we witnessed that with the organization you just mentioned, like Boko Haram and Al-Shabaab and the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And so basically there is a problem. There's a disconnect between Islam and Muslims of today.
What can be done? Can anything be done?
Obviously, I personally don't have the solution to it, but yes, what should be done is at least education and people should be told that they should go back in following the Quran, because right now what we see in Islam today is creation of so many sects. Yes, the Sunnis. Look at all the infighting that is going on today. You go to Syria, who is fighting who? Is the Muslims fighting the Muslims? And the Houthi rebels or the Shiites backed by Iran, there's a fighting going on between Saudi Arabia. That's the same situation exists with Iraqi forces. The similar situation exists in Iran. It's just divided between sects and even Boko Haram. They target Nigerians and any other people, and that's also an infighting in amongst the Muslims. A similar situation in Sudan, and this thing is going to continue. They're not on the same page. Whatever they are practicing is hypocrisy. The whole law of this Sharia laws that are being practiced and advocated, even unfortunately, even in the United States, here advocate Sharia laws, and I find them, if you look at history and if you study the Holy Quran, and visit all the 50 countries, that it is all based on sheer hypocrisy, and it's almost a parallel religion that is being run under the name of Islam.
Mohammed Rehman, author of Angels Are Crying, speaking with us from Karachi, Pakistan. Arab and Muslim groups in the United States are expressing alarm at the numbers of radicalized young Americans among the foreign fighters waging jihad in Syria. In recent testimony before Congress, the director of the U.S. National Intelligence Group, James Clapper, estimated more than 50 American Muslims have joined groups such as the self-styled Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, or ISIS. Among the more profile American jihadists who have taken to the public stage is Abu Muhammad, known as the American. A video posted on YouTube shows Muhammad speaking in heavily accented English, saying he lived in the United States for 10 or 11 years before traveling to Syria. He says he fought for a group affiliated with Al-Qaeda, then became a jihadist for ISIS. Author Jack Sheehan has given over 1,000 lectures across 3 continents, specializing on the issue of racial and ethnic stereotypes. He has written several books, including one called The TV Arab and another titled Arab and Muslim Stereotyping in American Popular Culture. He tells VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy that radicalized Muslim Americans are feeding the negative stereotypes of Arabs and Muslims in the American media.
Professor Jack Sheehan, what role does the U.S. media play in shaping up American public opinion with regard to the Middle East issues and the Arab-Israeli conflict?
Well, media images impact opinion, and impact by impacting opinion, you also impact policy. And so as a rule, media reflect Washington's policy, our media systems. And unfortunately, since our policies are very pro-Israeli historically, we see that in our news, we see it in entertainment shows. What troubles me is the lack of balance. You know, I'm all for seeing heroic Israelis as long as we can see heroic Arabs. I'm all for seeing, you know, Jewish Americans who are funny. If you can show some, you know, Yemeni who are funny. And what we've had historically on American television is that American Arabs and American Muslims are invisible. There are no in entertainment shows, with the exception of Danny Thomas years ago and Jamie Farr. We don't exist. It's as if we're not even in the United States. And in our place, we have clones of Al-Qaeda. I mean, even now, today, Arab Americans and Muslim Americans are portrayed in many TV shows as a threat to their country. Now, that to me is racism. I mean, we talk about racism in other areas, but I think that no one has brought this to light, that when you vilify, you know, American Arabs and American Muslims on a regular basis the way some TV entertainment shows have and some newscasters have, that's blatant racism, and the people responsible for it should be called to task. But the good news is that we can change, provided there's an attempt to bring about a change. And up until now, there are no forces that I know of at work trying to bring a change, trying to bring some balance, so that we see Semites together rather than at one another. And my life's quest has been to show the togetherness, to bring people together. And that can be done in entertainment, you know. It just, so far, it hasn't happened.
How does stereotyping in films and U.S. TV play in tipping the balance against Arabs and Muslims in public opinion's eye?
Well, I mean, if we all can't get on a plane and go to the Middle East and Israel to see for ourselves. So media systems teach us whom to love and whom to hate. These images, they've almost replaced the classroom because we spend an inordinate amount of time watching television and going to movies. And if all we see on television are evil Arabs, evil Muslims, evil American Arabs, evil American Muslims, it creates fear. And it has an impact on policy because policymakers watch television. You know, and they're influenced by these images, although they'll say they're not. They definitely are.
How does the introduction of ISIS add to this picture?
Well, it makes it much worse, or much more difficult, I should say, to dispel the stereotype because of the brutality of ISIS. And these are the images that we see over and over again, you know, of ISIS. What we don't seem to understand is that ISIS, they're not only killing people from the West, most of the people they're killing are fellow Muslims. And the Muslims are victims, but we don't see those Muslims as victims. We only see the perpetrators of violence, ISIS, you know? And we have to somehow show that there are people suffering under them and that they should have our empathy and we should help them, you know, in crushing ISIS.
Is there any room for Arabs and Muslims to use the same media tools to portray their real traits instead of the stereotyping?
I think what Arab diplomats have failed to do, and Muslim diplomats have failed to do, is they've not addressed the problem in entertainment. They focus just on Washington. They don't focus on Hollywood. They don't realize that Hollywood, in some ways, is that as effective, if not more effective, than Washington. And I would like to see an effort made not only by them, but by American Arab groups and American Muslim groups to change the narrative so that we are portrayed, that we appear on television and in film no better, no worse than anyone else. Just the same. You know, treat us fairly. And that's a very modest request.
As a media expert, what's your advice to repel the hate ideology of ISIS portrayed in their social media outlets?
Well, I think you if it were me, I would just say this is the lunatic fringe and it has to be crushed. And then I will also focus on the people who suffer as a result of that. I think that's what you do. You say that, you know, this is a minority of a minority, and they, you know, they are killing innocent people, and we have to stop it. The world has to stop it.
Author Jack Shaheen. 18-year-old Bernie Rawlinson has Asperger's syndrome, which is an autism spectrum disorder. People with Asperger's have difficulty with communication, eye contact, and maintaining relationships. His mother has for a long time wanted to write a book to help people better understand the feelings of children with autism. As Faiza El-Masri tells us, she has now published If You Were Me, with illustrations on each page by her son. Faith Lapthus narrates.
I am so happy to welcome everyone to our library book program featuring our very, very own Bernie Rawlinson. Let's give him a round of applause.
Friendly high school librarian Sharon Gibson introduces a very special artist to the library book program. 18-year-old Bernie Rawlinson, one of the students, stands in front of two dozen of his classmates and their parents to read from If You Were Me, the book he co-authored with his mother.
You're you and I'm me, and I'm glad I'm me. Different, but not less. You say, hey, man. I say, hello. You say, see ya. I say, goodbye. You're talkative and outgoing. I'm quiet and reserved. We're different, but that doesn't mean I'm less.
Bernie served as a prime model of academic achievement, and he served as a, you know, wonderful role model to the other students.
If You Were Me is a children's book. Bernie's mother, Anita Rawlinson, wrote it in her son's voice.
I just wanted it written in a way so that other children could possibly read it or have someone read it to them.
She says she also wanted to send a message to other parents of autistic children.
I just wanted them to feel that they weren't alone.
In the mother and son collaboration, Rawlinson would write a line or two and read it to Bernie, who would then illustrate the meaning.
I would leave it to him. I didn't necessarily want to tell him how to draw, because I wanted it to be exactly what he did, and it to come from his thoughts and his creativity.
If You Were Me tells Bernie's story, from being born to loving but inexperienced parents, to being diagnosed with Asperger's at age 3, to explaining why he doesn't have too many friends.
He's a loner most of the time, and then if he is approached by kids, he doesn't always know what to say. He may not say something appropriate. They may be talking about movies, and then he'll spurt out something about chicken or something not even related to the conversation that they're having.
If You Were Me, get placed in a special program with other children whose parents heard the same word, and you're in class with no more than 10 students, you would hear the words, the special needs to describe you, and sometimes people are talking about you as though you're not there.
I don't like to be ignored by someone be talking about me or people just not saying a word to you at all.
Bernie wants people to know he's living a full life. He attends school and, after class, goes to a part-time job at the library, and he enjoys the work he's doing. Anya Plana Hutt, his special education teacher, is proud of him.
The fact that Bernie was able to illustrate his mother's book and, you know, share it with so many people, I think it's a very good message. It allows people to understand how it is to be on Bernie's side of the road.
She says it's important for the community to understand people with disabilities.
Individuals with disabilities are like you and me. They could be sitting next to you in a bus. They could be walking along the sidewalk with you. And if you don't understand how they interact with others, you may find yourself perplexed and you don't realize that maybe you should be more patient with other people. You should understand what they're going through, how to empathize with them. Our students are trying to be productive as well. And for them to be productive, they need people who understand how they work. You need to encourage them and support them.
And this book might just get a lot more people to understand, encourage, and support Bernie and others with autism. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. And you can also listen to today's International Edition or any previous show. Go to voanews.com, Go to Programs in the upper right-hand corner and scroll on down to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.